This conference is being recorded.
This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network, and you're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Radio. Joining us this morning is Dr. Theo Colborn of the Endocrine Disruptors Exchange. Good morning, Dr. Colborn.
Hi, we're the Endocrine Disruption Exchange.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm fine. How are you?
I feel really energetic and excited about this interview. You're a very, very special person, and you have some great news for us. You know, just tell us about what you have accomplished in the last, you know, several weeks here.
Well, basically what we managed to do to get John Kerry in the Senate and Jim Moran in the House to introduce what is called the Endocrine Disruption Prevention Act of 2009. Amazing. We were able to get this through with all the activity that's going on. It's in essence, basically what it does, Don, is take the responsibility away from the regulatory agencies to determine the safety of a chemical. There's so much conflict of interest. There's so much politics. There's just what you call a constipation within the regulatory agencies where things move so slowly. And we've moved that over to what is called the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and in a program they have there called the National Tox Program. And, you know, back in 1996, when Congress told EPA to come up with a set of screens and assays to be able to detect estrogens and other hormones in the environment, EPA set out on a very, very tough trail. It was very difficult. And because of all of the problems I just mentioned, here we are 13 going on to 14 years later, and we don't have those kinds of assays, those kind of screens, to basically say this particular chemical causes this particular problem. But all the while that was going on over at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, there was a program called an extramural program where they continued and have continued to this day to fund the research on the campuses around the country to basically provide the information that we have now. As people know, they hear all the time, there's a new study that came out that links this particular chemical with that particular problem. All of that research was being done over at the NIEHS. So it just seemed like it was time to move that responsibility over to where this information is in-house. There are a number of people working there who have basically been grown up in training under the principles of endocrinology, which are different from those from toxicology. And they have embarked on a number of research programs where they are beginning to develop some terrific protocols that will be able to detect not just one endocrine effect that a chemical might cause, but many. And so this is what we managed to do. Now, the bill is only introduced, Don. The biggest hurdle ahead now is to get someone to pay attention to that bill and make sure that it gets before the House and the Senate so that it can be passed. And the job now is for all of your members and members around the country. We have to set up a network and let people know they must let their representatives in the House and the Senate, where they live around the country, know that they should sign on to this bill. Let Senator Kerry know. Let Congressman Jim Moran know that they like this and they want this. Because, quite frankly, there's going to be a lot of pushback. And I'm sure the pushback is going to get to them long before we even begin to reach out to the public wide enough to show the support that the people really have behind this bill.
Well, tell me, what is it, you know, what are some of the most powerful things that you can share with us that would be the kind of things that would motivate someone here in New York, someone in California, someone in the various other states of the U.S.? What can you tell them about endocrine disrupting chemicals and the diseases that we're suffering that is going to cause them to make that call to their representative and their senator?
Oh, that's a big question. But let's start at the top. Just look at the health statistics that have just cropped up over the last 10 years and the health problems that are really burning up the money that are in our health care programs now and costing us so much money to take care of these people, starting with autism, ADHD, early childhood cancers, diabetes, obesity, early testicular cancer, and then later cancers, breast and prostate cancers. All of these have been traced back to experience of the embryo and the fetus. In other words, from fertilization to birth. Prior to birth, they've been traced back to this source. This includes also Alzheimer's and the Parkinson's. What we're going to try to do is put on our website so people can go there and see this list of disorders that are just plaguing all of us. I don't think you sit down and you ask someone, how about your family? What's the health in your family? And they're having disorders that they never had in their families and disorders that back around the turn of the century were rare. And these are not rare anymore. They're very common. So that would be one good reason. And much of the research has come out of the NIEHS and also research that's come out of Europe and Japan and China, Korea, where their governments have been funding the kind of research that not what EPA was giving us, but the kind of research that the NIEH was giving us, that basically endocrine-driven disorders based on this hypothesis, and it's no longer a hypothesis, that extremely low doses of exposure to these chemicals during development can alter how our children are constructed, and how they function later in life, and what their health is going to be like. So this research basically now can be pulled in through the NIEHS and all the work that they have. They can compile that, and basically if they go to our website, you'll see that we've done some compiling of that under a product we have on there called Critical Windows of Development. About 10 years ago, I began trying to figure out, what do we know about how we build a baby? How is a baby formed? There's that mystery, that inner space research that we basically have not poured any money into is needed badly. So we started searching the literature. I had a number of pre-doctoral and post-doctoral people come in and try to help me work with what is this model. And if you go to that, you will see that we know very little about how all the different parts of the brain develop and the parts of the female reproductive system, the male reproductive system, and so on. So, but then what we did was take the literature and pick a couple of chemicals that people know something about, and we chose dioxin. And if you look, and this is all low-dose research, this is in parts per trillion and parts per billion range of exposure that has been confirmed in animals in the laboratory. Actually, we got the clues from what was going on from animals in the wild. And now there are all these human epidemiological studies that are becoming linked to dioxin. But basically all we put in our spreadsheet was what came out of the laboratory where they did the research for prenatal exposure. And you will see that practically every single developing system is affected by dioxin while the baby is in the womb. This is holding true now with bisphenol A, BPA, this plastic that everybody wants out of baby bottles. Getting it out of the baby bottle is too late. The worst part and the most serious part of exposure, let's say the most vulnerable stage of development, is in the womb. And they can go to our website and click on that and see what we know about bisphenol A. That whole system, again, all those parts of the endocrine system are turn red. And also, as you click in there, you can click on a little asterisk in there, and it will show you exactly the study and what they studied and what they discovered and how that, at certain stages of development in the mouse, are equivalent to what is the number of weeks or months in human development. So it's but we've built this model. So the evidence is there. I think that message needs to get out. the local newspapers are beginning to pick up on the news. There are not major press. Of course, there are reasons why this kind of information barely reaches the evening television news and the and the newspapers. And quite frankly, endocrine disruption, the only ED you hear on television is erectile dysfunction. And you don't hit the other ED that comes along with it, which is endocrine disruption. And endocrine disruption is causing erectile dysfunction. And people should link those two and think about that.
Yeah, I wondered a little bit about that. You know, when I have a history of having eaten too much of the canned sardines and the canned beans, and I'm thinking that BPA is kind of slightly affecting my own erectile dysfunction. That's, you know, something that people don't like talking about, but, you know, I'm having a little issue with that myself right now, and boy, I ate so much of those canned sardines and those canned beans. See, I spent a lot of time in the wilderness, actually, and in that kind of setting, at, you know, there wasn't a lot of hunting to be done. There's not much wildlife in some of the boreal areas we go, and there's so much of the other hunting that goes on that the natives, you know, they're free to hunt a lot, and, you know, we don't. So had to have something to eat, and it was quick, and the sardines and the canned beans got a bunch of BPA out of that.
Well,
it really kind of...
Yeah. Well, of course, and then you have to think about the mercury in the sardines and canned tuna. But actually, Harvard School of Public Health did a study, a large study, and also found that the levels of testosterone have been dropping over the last 20 or 30 years. And so there is an epidemiological study that supports that, the drop in testosterone levels. The younger you are, the less testosterone you're producing, which makes the older men, quite right now, quite more valuable. They're more precious, I always say to an older audience. When the older men are sitting in the audience and I talk to them, I say, see how precious you are. This is because they're the kind of chemicals that we're concerned about are those that get into our homes. They're in our private and personal lives, and we can't avoid them. And these chemicals, like the bisphenol A, is a resin. It is in, and one of the reasons that the natural gas industry right now is in a slump is because better than 50% of the natural gas that's produced is used to make the plastics that are in your automobiles, our cars, our headsets that I'm sitting here, I'm looking at my computer. Everything around us is full of BPA, these very, very small molecules that they don't bioaccumulate, but they're in our presence every day, and the large epidemiological monitoring programs that have been going on have shown that it's just sort of, it's coming and going through our body all day long, and it seems to hang in there at about 2 parts per billion. In the laboratory, that's the level at which these chemicals are causing the effects. So it's a very, very big concern. You know, it's this whole issue is linked with fossil fuels. Dioxins, where do we get them? We get them when we burn coal, when we burn things. Polyvinyl products, when they're burned, basically, and they're, again, made from the cracking of crude oil. These products are linked to our fossil fuel problem today. It's another reason we need to find alternative energy. And I'm sorry that the climate change people haven't picked up on this, because this would give them one more bullet to really focus on and realize why we have to find alternatives.
Well, we have a good college environmental group. As I went to the State University of New York at Potsdam College, and I'm in that area right now, and I've been, you know, doing information tables on dioxins and some of the exhaust pollutants that are, you know, known human carcinogens like benzene and PAHs.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, I've gotten to know better this environmental group. It's called Middle Ground. They're at SUNY Potsdam College, New York State University of New York. And they are very, very excited about this whole climate change, this global climate change issue. And then when I was making that point that there was so much kind of common ground between us with this matter of combustion being the problem, combustion creating the dioxins, combustion, you know, producing the CO2 and all this, And so they're excited about that, and hopefully other college environmental groups will get into it too, because they certainly have a beautiful energy for bringing change. They have done some great events around this part of New York State, and it feels like something special is beginning to, you know, come together and happen, really.
I have a DVD that I have made called The Male Predicament, which now I will send anywhere. And I invite you to tell those kids on the campus there at Potsdam to, actually it's online, it's on my website, but I hate to tell people to sit in front of their computer and watch a PowerPoint lecture. They can, it isn't a PowerPoint, well it is, it's full of PowerPoints, but they could easily put it in a projector on a screen and actually sit and look at it as a group. And look at it, and then what I do is, when they let me know when they're going to do that, I then schedule the time, like I'm just doing with you now. I call in, and if they have any questions, I take the questions. And of course, that's the way I've been working with campuses around the country ever since I ended up here in Colorado and in my old age and find it more difficult to travel. I've been doing lectures on campuses and live. They have the PowerPoint lecture there. I do it here. I read it to them over the telephone, and then we take questions and answers afterwards. But now I can send this lecture ahead, which they can look at, and then I'll sit and talk to the class or the group, whatever it is, afterwards. So, you know, let people know that, and I think if they go to our website, they will find that these DVDs are available. We did, our first batch we did was on the what you need to know about natural gas production, because you're sitting there right in New York, and it was a lot of our data that the New York City Water Board has used to build their case that maybe we don't want to drill in our watershed. Right. And but we had 1,000 of those made up, and when they came in, we looked at one of them and found out there was a funny little thing near the end of the lecture where a red arrow danced across my head. And we thought, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? Well, we got so many calls for them, we got rid of that 1,000 in a minute. It was like within a week they were practically gone. So we've ordered a new 1,000, which without the red arrows over my head. And these are moving so rapidly because of this natural gas craze that's going across the country. You know, they're finding natural gas where they never saw it before. And even though it doesn't even, they haven't even proven that it is a real, going to be a good gas field, they're going to start drilling in those areas. So anyway, that is available too. And basically what that was, natural gas was being developed quite near my home, and I was very concerned about it and began being called by people who were getting sick, and I didn't know what to do for them. And then the Oil and Gas Accountability Project, which is a nationwide project set up to be a watchdog of the oil and gas industry back in 1999, they began sending me what are called the material safety data sheets that the industries put on their products when they have anything in them that's dangerous and might harm the people who are using it or the emergency people who come to clean up the mess. Excuse me a minute. So anyway, we began building a database on that. And if you're interested, that's, a lot of that information is on our website as well. But the irony here is that industry does not tell us everything they're putting in their products. So as we are now beginning to look at what is in the pits, the evaporation pits,
right.
Something has to be done with the water that comes up out of the ground with the gas, and we're finding that the things in the evaporation pits are not matching what they are telling us they're using, and many of them, in one instance, is in New Mexico, and another one we found here in Colorado, better than 90% of the chemicals are on what we call the CERCLA list, the Superfund list. These are toxic chemicals that basically are going to make every one of those well pads a little mini Superfund site.
How horrible. Are there any endocrine disrupting chemicals in that mix?
Well, I'm glad you asked. it's running about 40-50% of the products have endocrine disrupting chemicals in them.
Wow, it's gonna be kind of hard to stay away from those things, isn't it?
They're everywhere. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the trouble is, when we began, you know, with toxicology, we looked for the obvious and gross endpoints. We didn't look for those insidious endpoints. Who would have thought to look for diabetes or obesity? Think of it, obesity caused by endocrine disrupting chemicals. But the link is there. We found it. We know it. And
in other words,
the irony of this is, in so many of the multi-generational studies where they would dose animals and then look at their offspring, you know, to look at the pups, they would always say, oh, the animals are, look at how robust and large our baby animals are. They were heavier. They were big. They were big babies. But the toxicologists thought, hey, this is great. But this isn't great. We know now. This isn't what you want. And if they had looked carefully, they would have seen that the fat was laid down differently and in different places. They would have probably found also that the breast fat would have been different. You know, the tissues would have been different. But no one went to that extent because no one, the people who are doing toxicology are not trained in endocrinology.
So in other words, what you're saying about obesity in particular as far as something that is brought to be as a result of exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals in utero and lactationally, that people, you know, the offspring, these, say, the young people now, when they were in utero, it's highly likely that they were exposed to endocrine disrupting chemicals that predisposed them to be obese?
I'll bet you on that one. I'll lay the odds, yes.
And you have seen this in animals?
We've seen it in animals. We definitely have. It's repeated over and over and over again. When you think about it, look at these people who never in their family were they heavy people. Suddenly they're putting on this weight in the funniest places, too. You know, it's in one piece of literature, they call it grotesque fat. You know, where is this stuff coming from? That can be induced in the laboratory. So you need to get into the literature. You can find this in our database. I mean, in the information that we have on our database, we have tried to keep up to date. It's difficult when I work with just a small team, and most of them work part-time. But we do have also on our website, we're trying to keep put every low-dose study of bisphenol A on there. And we just updated that recently. So you can see how many assays were done, who did the assays. We even put on the negative studies, but we show you who paid for the studies too. And you will see the negative studies were paid by the industry folks that were done in commercial laboratories. You look at the studies where they're getting these endpoints and repeatedly in different labs under different conditions, treating the animals under different conditions and even different strains of animals, they're getting the same results.
It's a little different sounding, but I can hear you.
Okay,
yes.
I dropped my telephone. I turned around and I'm talking here using my arms and I knocked my telephone off. Okay.
Well,
so,
it's good to know that you are so, you know, energetic, and I like this. I like this thing of gesticulating. While I'm sitting here, I'm moving my hands a lot too, so we have a lot of similar behaviors that are, you know, good for communicating, I'm sure.
Well, I know when I sit and talk with people, I do the same thing. So I've often knocked over a glass when I'm sitting in a dining room, you know, with a group of people
talking.
There
you go. I've had that experience.
There you go. The glass of water, you know. Wow.
Yep.
So, this evidence is there. The EPA has never had the staff or and thought that they could even use peer-reviewed literature. The EPA has been told you can only regulate when a certain protocol to test a chemical has been used to prove that it causes cancer or causes this or causes that. Those old protocols will detect those other effects, which we need to keep doing. But this endocrine issue is entirely different, and it's a different kind of health study. It's disease-based. What they'll do at the NIEHS is take those chemicals that they know are linked with these diseases and really work on developing protocols to be able to detect those kinds of effects using animals in the laboratory. So basically then, commercial laboratories can start learning how to do this. But there are no commercial laboratories out there now, I will say, that I know of, who are advertising that they have come up with any kind of assay, and they won't, because they need the protocols given to them before they will be able to do what has to be done. But we also need to train people to do this kind of research, and that's the beauty of what is going on with the research at the NIEHS. It is funding not commercial laboratories, it's funding academic laboratories, where, and in the bill, we make sure there is money provided so that they can hire pre-doctoral students, graduate-level students, and postdoctoral students to work on this, to build these people, move these people into this new discipline of endocrine disruption. And they're going to be in tremendous demand. There's going to be work out there for those people. And it's going to be a challenge. It's like a new, entirely new science. But my concern is, and I heard on the radio and also on television, I heard it on NPR and heard it on the evening news, that we spend $8.4 billion a year in outer space research. And we are not spending $100 million a year on what I call inner space research. So our bill is only an authorization bill. I mean, it tells the NIEH what it has to do. But somehow, some way, we have got to get to our legislators and say, this is a program we need, just like we had a Manhattan Project. We need another Manhattan Project this time. Remember when we built the bomb?
Right.
Yep, industry. Everybody came together, and we built a bomb in 2 years and 10 months. We now are at the stage where we need a Manhattan-like project on inner space so we can address this problem, because it goes to the core of our economic problems. It goes to the core, I would say, of our international problems, because also these chemicals are affecting the children's ability to learn. It affects their IQ. It's affecting that part of the brain where you are able to arrive at some conclusions about the consequences of what you're seeing, doing, or reading, or hearing about, that's destroyed before these children are born. So these people cannot think for themselves. They can't process information. They're easily led. And then also, you've got this problem with the autistic children that can't feel empathy. They can't feel at all what you are feeling, and so share something with you. This ability to socialize is not there. We need people who can do all those things. We need people also, I listened this morning, people with courage. I don't know where courage comes from, but I think it comes from something really good inside us. And we need leaders who are courageous, but they're also healthy. They haven't had to nurse a disorder throughout their life, which has compromised their ability to reach their fullest potential. We have to have extremely healthy people to go around the world and doing what Obama's doing and a lot of our other leaders. They're pretty healthy people, or they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. And that's my concern. We're raising people who are always going to have to be taken care of. We're not raising enough people to pay taxes. Instead, they're going to depend upon others, like a caretaker society. And that's what you're hearing all this time with Medicare, Medicaid, the health care reform. And they're not taking into concern the really core of the problem. And the core of the problem is we are producing people who are less healthy.
It seems so clear when you state it like that. Yet why and how can it be that it took to, this time? What was wrong that, I like to look at this bigger picture kind of aspect of this. What can we learn from having done this, from having, suffered and created this disease and suffered it ourselves and, been predisposed to have all these horrible things happen to us and never really have a life at all? What can we learn from this so it doesn't happen again?
Well, one of the things, I just don't know. This is my big concern. We let technology get ahead of us.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about nanotechnology, think of bisphenol A. Bisphenol A works at nano levels. It's a very, very small molecule. What they're finding about bisphenol A is that it doesn't need a pore or a cell opening, a pore opening in a cell. It doesn't need a transporter system to get in the cell. When bisphenol A gets in the body, it just gets into any cell it wants to. That's nanoparticle stuff. And we're pushing nanoparticulate technology, creating all these nanoparticulate, depending upon nanoparticles to provide the needs, our needs. But we haven't even begun to understand what the nanoparticles that we produce to make plastics and some other things are doing to us now. This is a big concern. And, of course, because of this, I think there's a lot of pushback on what's trying to be done with bisphenol A and endocrine disruption research, because I think a lot of the major corporations realize that they produce products that aren't very safe, and where are we going now, and this sort of thing. But in our bill, there is a clause that says that this research that will be done at the NIEHS will be completely conflict of interest free. And there's a lot of legislation being written on that. We've already introduced into the bill at this early stage that kind of information. There will be more conflict of information, conflict of interest clauses added to the bill, I'm sure, when it now goes to the committees in the House and the Senate where they'll be worked on, because that's going to strengthen that bill. So, again, I think the integrity in science, I think the work the Union of Concerned Scientists have been doing is terrific. Those other organizations are really getting to the core, and I think last week Obama began removing people from key offices in federal government that are just too tied with industry, and I think we're going to see more and more of that. It's suddenly coming clear that we can't have the corporations controlling science or our agencies, which they are now.
Well, maybe that's probably the big lesson, that the money can't decide everything, especially with regards to our health and our minds, and you know, and they're the same thing in a lot of ways. They're very interconnected. But this thing of, like, say what you were saying about needing the character, needing the courage, needing the clear-mindedness, and needing a good health, all those things that we need to be able to function and, you know, live well here and around the rest of the world and just be strong and good parts of, you know, the world life. The money is just so awful to think that it just kind of did things that were with total disregard to those very most important of things.
Mm-hmm. But they're so subtle. They're extremely subtle. You know, I sit now... well, there are a whole bunch of us old-timers now who met, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, and someone said, okay, you know, I'm older than all of them now. Remember, I'm in my 80s. A lot of these scientists who came up through this work out of the Great Lakes and out off the campuses are now in their 60s. But as we began looking around us, sitting around a table, we said, well, okay, now let's look at your family. Let's look at my family. Look at my child. Look at your child. And what's happened to your children and your grandchildren. And it was just a horror story when we began talking. And there were so many overlaps, so many similarities. But it's a subtle thing that each family suffers and they talk about and we take care of these problems. But we move on. And it's got away from us. Just truly got away from us.
And so, do you think that is part of the impetus, part of the, you know, the motivating force? You know, what is galvanizing? What's kind of driving? What's making it different now, so we can have some hope that the money won't rule, and that we'll get these good science-based, knowledge-based, caring about the quality of life-based, you know, decisions and actions out of the whole society, you know, government and the public and the scientists and everybody working together. Is that what's different now, that everybody gets it?
You know, do you think everybody gets it now? No, they're fighting it. I mean, I'm talking to some pretty brilliant people every day, and they think we're pushing the envelope. that we're making a big issue out of this, that it's overblown, that these connections have not been made. Well, how many connections do you have to make in the laboratory? You can't go out and dose people.
Right.
They're asking for dead bodies now, truly.
Right.
And so there are these people pushing back. But if it had not been for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences very quietly doing their work over at the NIEHS with very little interference from industry, we would not have the information we have today. So it's these very, and these were courageous people. Some of these people sat on the National Academy of Sciences review of what we knew about endocrine disruption and what they went through and how they were vilified. And they're still being vilified. Every time one of these new pioneers, I call them, they're the progressive pioneer 21st century scientists, that's what I'm calling them, break with a new paper, you wouldn't believe the pushback they get probably within a week. I mean, it just starts, and they're criticized. I mean, I often call somebody who makes a new breakthrough, and they're not excited about their breakthrough. They were, but then they just get this backlash that it just weakens them. They feel, okay, this is threatening my job. You know, am I going to get tenure next year because I made this statement? I was willing to speak about the implications of my research. This is one of the most serious things. So where when a scientist talks about the implications of his research, they get vilified. And yet if the scientists don't speak out and explain to the public what it means when they find this change in an enzyme shift, when they see that this cell didn't go this way and they didn't make buds the way they should early on in early development, if the scientists aren't allowed to explain that without getting criticized, we're in a real serious situation. But remember, the industries, through their trade associations, the American Petroleum Institute, the American Plastics Council, the American Chemistry Council, Crop Life, which is the pesticide trade association, the food packaging industry, I could go on and on and on. They hire the most brilliant public relations corporations in the world, and they hire them to protect their bottom line, and they manage to just put a twist on things. They seem to manage at times to find out what one of the agencies or one of the or the National Academy of Science is going to release. How do these people get in advance a shot at those studies that are being released by the National Academy of Science so they can come out and pick out the one good thing that they found in their study and play up that one good thing so that when the study comes out and it begins talking about the things that they really did the study for and were looking for and they found, it gets downplayed. It doesn't get it into the newspaper. I mean, I could take you through years and years of this kind of control of the media. Clever control, very sophisticated. Look at how beautiful Archer Daniel Midland's ads are. General Electric's ads. These companies that tell you they're going to take care of you. They never advertise a product. When you see that on television, you should be asking, why are they doing that?
Right.
Truly. But we're not smart enough. You know, it's hard to believe that something like this is going on, but it is.
Well, it's good to know that at least there are some beginning to be some better media alternatives. You know, we're not, you know, just like playing our own trumpet or anything, for lack of a better way of describing that. You know, kind of blowing our own horn, I guess is the old expression. But it does feel good to be able to do a radio program like this and have that out there where anybody on earth can listen if they so choose, and to be able to, like, do media advisories with email and this kind of thing and cause more and more people to be aware that sometimes, and that there can be this type of media that's provided that doesn't have any money involved with it. It just has clear thinking and concern for health and love of the earth, you know, that drives it and gets it done. So it is wonderful in a certain way that we're starting to find these alternatives to what didn't work and what brought us to this awful place.
Well, I certainly appreciate what you're doing because I feel, you know, maybe one in your audience will respond, but that one person might be the person who will make a tremendous change. You never know where you're going to find a friend. You never know where you're going to hit the jackpot, I call it. You know, people will say, well, you come speak here. I walked into pretty belligerent audiences and actually walked out feeling quite good that there were people there who were willing to defend me and get up. Oftentimes when I speak afterwards, it turns into like a, what do they call them, revival meeting. People want to get up and testify, and they start telling their stories that build upon what I said. It's interesting. Oh, and yet I've been where I have just been treated terribly, and walk away and say, well, that was, you know, that was 24 hours or 36 hours shot. At least I'm not traveling anymore, so I don't feel as though I'm wasting 3 days instead of 1 day. But, you know, going somewhere always took a day going and a day coming home and a day there, and then you go and talk to an audience and just hope you can get through to someone in the audience, and not one person even wants to come speak to you afterwards, and you sort of sit there alone. You begin to wonder whether it was even worthwhile going. And I think we're getting smarter, a lot of us are, about where you go speak and to whom you speak, and save your energy for where you have the biggest bang for your buck. And I don't know, maybe we're doing that. And I think it took a long time for people to convince me that we needed a website for my nonprofit. And then all I kept thinking was, but I don't have staff to do the science, and keeping up the website is a full-time job, and we can't afford to hire somebody to do it. But we're managing, and it's certainly not the best. We try to do what we can, but it does take away from the amount of work that we can be doing, compiling the science and putting it into a form so that it's meaningful to the public. There aren't many agencies that allow people to do the kind of research I do, where we do huge, what you call database, large collection of information over broad expanses of interest, and pulling them together and trying to pull out of that some meaning to show what's happening at, say, the global perspective. And so it's, again, there are just so many people, there are just so many students that have come through now this training on campuses. We need a lot more, and I know those programs where they're going on the campuses around the country, they're so excited. And in many instances, it was only because some of the products or the chemicals that were being used to store things in laboratories on campuses, where people were just studying how the brain develops or how the ovary produces an egg or something like that. And then they began to have problems and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And it was because one of these chemicals, these endocrine disrupting chemicals, had been used to make the product that they were, the instrument or the equipment that they were using in the laboratory. So a lot of this work now is sort of serendipitous, and it's been through serendipity that we have been finding these connections. But we can't survive on serendipity. We need very well-planned research designs and protocols established, and that can happen at the NIEHS. They've got the capacity there. They know how to use the people on the campuses to do this. So this will keep the money within academia where we need it, not in commercial laboratories that like EPA was using that can't do this kind of science.
And the Endocrine Disruption Prevention Act, that will get the science done, it will develop these protocols. Where does it go then with actually getting the regulatory actions taken, wherein, you know, the chemicals would be removed from the marketplace and we would not suffer the exposure?
Okay, the ultimate challenge for the NIEHS is to set up a tier program, a tier system of concern, level of concern. They will establish a clearly level of concern. I mean, if we know this much about a chemical, it goes in tier one. A little more goes in tier two. A little more goes in tier three. And of course, if you know a lot, goes in tier four. That sort of thing. I'm just making this very simple. But that, when they get to that point where they have determined what tier this particular chemical is in, that information must be sent to the regulatory agencies. And then it is up to the, the regulatory agencies have 150 days to respond back to the NIEHS so they can see what they're going to do and, you know, and maybe collaborate on something, I don't know, who knows. But also, they have to report to Congress. Now, right now, there are hundreds of people working around the country and in Washington, D.C., to rewrite the Toxic Substances Control Act, which, when it was passed back in the late 70s, I know it was 77, 78, it looked like the answer. When I saw that come on out, I thought, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. But over the years, special interests got in and tweaked words here, tweaked words there, weakened the thing, so it's been totally useless. So now, here's our time. This is the time to rewrite TSCA. It's up, being worked on right now. And now, this is a gift to those who are doing that, because their EPA is going to get this information, the FDA, the Consumers Product Safety Commission, the Department of Agriculture, all those people who regulate, they're going to get information, and it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. TSCA can pick up on this now and say, you have to take this information and do something with it.
Yeah, yeah. That has to be there. So hopefully TSCA is going to get, you know, get done right. So that this is the whole such a problem. There's the science. You get to the science to understand what needs to be done, but then something has to click and something has to work to get it done. You know, this thing of,
this has been the problem all along, this tremendous disconnect between the science the government has been accumulating and the ability to make it work. This disconnect between getting it into some kind of a regulatory process where it will work. And, of course, now, and you've got to stop doing risk analysis and you've got to stop doing cost-benefit analysis. Because, and cost-benefit analysis is now going to have to take into consideration the millions of people who are getting sick, which has never been done. It has to go beyond the corporate net profit level.
Yeah. Why did we ever settle for that?
Yeah, at least we've got this tool that was never there, that when back in 1996 when I heard Congress had done it, I thought, oh, this is great. But after a year sitting on the EPA EDSTAC committee, 2 years on that committee, went to the EdMoves committee and saw what was happening over there, it was futile. It was hopeless. The bench scientists who had discovered endocrine disruption, who had written about it, published on it, were never invited to come in and work on that problem. They were never brought to the table. That's how serious, that's how that was so beautifully controlled.
Well,
and that was a mistake we made. But thank God for the NIEHS down there in its quiet little silent way with very little money was basically funding this research that needed to be done.
But what is going to be different? You know, what is your hope? How is it going to be different that once, you know, the science comes from NIEHS, it's they're this tier four, you know, some high level of science-based concern? What is going to force EPA and the other regulatory agencies to act despite all the pressure they get from corporations?
The new law. And I think public interest. And I think there's going to be enough evidence here for our legislators to really, and this is the problem. I hate to see them come down on a product or something we're exposed to postnatally. You know, let's get this out of the bottle. Let's get this out of that. I'm hoping that they'll begin to think more seriously about this in the public health policy, which there are a whole bunch of new articles that have just come out recently, and I'm going to put them on my website. An editorial by Linda Birnbaum, the new director of the NIEHS,
right,
who came over from EPA. The article that was in Science magazine, an editorial by Schwarzman and Wilson on this new science, this new age science that has to be done differently, and how it's opening all kinds of doors. And if you read the bill, you see we didn't tell the NIEHS to go for this particular mechanism of action or that mechanism of action, because every week there's something new. we've got to give them flexibility. As we learn more, we suddenly say, oh my gosh, we have to look at this. We need to consider that. It gives, and so the NIEH has the flexibility. And right now, I know enough of the people down there and the people that are working there, they come from many disciplines, and there are going to be a lot more coming from many disciplines. And if you read the Endocrine Society's letter of support, they say, we want to get more involved in this. We want to be invited now. We endocrinologists want to be there. This is exciting.
Yep, yep. So you really think that with this better, more science, better science, kind of more honored science, having this kind of plan, this protocol, this way for the science to be brought into the regulatory agencies, together with the better knowledge amongst the public and the better informed lawmakers, you think that'll be enough to just basically get the job done without the interference from corporations?
Oh, no. There's going to be pushback. Come on.
Well, I know there's going to be pushback.
There are going to be a lot of people who are going to push back on this for many reasons. I don't know. It's amazing, but there will be. And, you have to expect this, Dan. A pushback is just like the sun. It comes up every day.
Yep, but
going to be there.
Can it be overcome?
That's right. And I think a lot of it's going to be overcome by the number of people who look around them.
Okay.
And realize how many people have disorders in their families that, where the devil did this come from? A lot of people suffering guilt because they thought they did something wrong and did something to their children, or something happened, especially when it comes into the area of behavior, social behavior and that sort of thing, which there's going to be a lot more breaking on how these chemicals affect the brain in social behavior and how you're programmed to behave later in life. This all going to come, it's coming. We see the statistics year after year, the incidence increasing so that the prevalence is so much greater. Believe me, I think it's all coming together, but unfortunately, why did we have to reach this crisis stage before we got smart enough? And are we going to be able to turn it around? That's going to be the next big issue.
Yes, it's really something that would, there's certainly no clear view. It's like we're all in this, very strange and dangerous and very risk-fraught situation. And I guess we're just figuring it out as we go. And I'm glad you're there at the helm of this ship, in a lot of ways, getting, as much as you're getting done as quickly as possible, too. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and tell that Potsdam crowd to look for the opportunity on our website. We're going to put letters to Congress on the website for organizations, for individuals. We already have over 175 scientists who have signed on to the bill, and unfortunately, I realize that only half of the list that we sent out to people reach those that we tried to get to, and also we're looking for support from major organizations. So if you know organizations, but they will be able to go to our website and find the opportunity. Give us a couple more days. We're really swamped with the Christmas holiday and our snowstorms that keep us from getting to work and a little bit of the flu. We really got behind. So, but it will all be there. And, of course, this is going on disc anyway, isn't it? We're not live today. So, anyway, we should have that up and ready so that people can do that. But unless, I'll tell you quite frankly, because of all the other bills that have been introduced, the House bill was one of 4,000 was introduced. The Senate bill was one of 2,000. These bills will get buried and never go anywhere. We have to keep pushing on this. We've got to get this bill through committee, and then what is called markup, when the Congress, the House, and the Senate work together, and then get that bill introduced, and so that the people, this institution that's going on down at the NIEHS, basically is established, and then we're all going to have to work to make sure that they begin to get the kind of money that outer space research is getting.
Well, I can tell you one thing. that we will do, and we're a member organization of the New York State Breast Cancer Network, and we're a part of, you know, we have listserv kind of access to the other organizations, and we have a steering committee and all these good things. And this has been such a large part of, you know, the kind of the growing, you know, the really kind of more dynamic part of the, you know, the network, and becoming more focused on education and more focused on endocrine disruptors and more focused on these things. I'm sure that you will get a considerable amount of support for your legislation here from the Breast Cancer Network. If they don't have, you know, all the information right now, they'll have it, because I'll make sure they do have it.
Well, make sure they get to their New York senators and congressmen. We've got Nita Lowey's on already. So we've got one person on from New York. And Hinchy, isn't Hinchy from New York, too?
Yes.
Yeah, so he's already signed on. So we've done well by New York.
Well, I'm hoping for Schumer and Gillibrand, for sure.
Well, you get some of the others for us if you can.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dan, is there any chance of getting a copy of this?
I'll send you a media advisory with all the pertinent information.
And how to get to it.
Yeah, exactly, how to do the download.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much.
Yep.
And carry on.
Have a great holiday season and a great solstice.
Thank you, too. Okay, that's right. We're almost there.
Almost there.
Oh, yeah, I love the winter solstice. Okay. All right, bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.